Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 264, recorded for the week of June 12th, 2024. AWS Audit Manager, because even AI needs a babysitter. Good evening, Jonathan and Ryan. And actually, technically, Matt is off babysitting right now, his daughter, who he's trying to get to go to bed, who's not cooperating. So he may pop in at any time here in the recording, but or he may be fighting a baby for the next 5 hours. You know, like babies, they're fun.
Yeah.
Have children, people. It's, you know, rewarding and satisfying, allegedly.
Yeah. You can't even call it babysitting if it's your own.
I mean, I guess not. He's parenting.
Okay, he's parenting. Yep.
It's been a little bit of a busy week. Today was the Reinforce keynote. So if they announce anything cool tomorrow or the next day, we'll cover it next week.
But I will be very surprised.
And I'd be very shocked. Yeah. But they did have some good stuff this week, even before reInvent. So first up, this one apparently didn't make main stage at Reinforce, but Audit Manager is introducing a common control library that provides common controls with predefined and pre-mapped AWS data sources. This makes it easy for your governance, risk, and compliance teams to use the common control library to save time when mapping enterprise controls into Audit Manager for evidence collection, reducing their dependence on those pesky IT teams named Ryan. You can view the compliance requirements for multiple frameworks such as PCI or HIPAA, associated with the same common control in one place, making it easier to understand your audit readiness across multiple frameworks simultaneously.
It's the dream, automated evidence generation. And now with the context of like known frameworks.
What control it's for.
Yeah. Because that's always the challenge, you know, or the last step of that. Of the translation of like, this is the control. Hey, we need all these controls to do this level of compliance. You're like,
No, I would jump you to implement that control. Oh, in the worst way possible? Let me try again.
Yeah.
Let me give you something that's reasonable that we can actually work with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's always the joy. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me how much time compliance teams take mapping controls across each other, like ISO to PCI to CSA. Like, I mean, I think half of their job is just mapping controls in PowerPoint spreadsheets. Like, I don't mean to belittle them because I'm sure they're doing a lot of other valuable things, but I've stared at a lot of control mapping spreadsheets in my day.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have to, right? Like, think about like they have to evidence the controls for each one, right? And so it's like, it's the only way to map reduce that task.
You know, it's like that XKCD comic where they're like, there's 11 control family, you know, standards out there. And then, you know, you're trying to fix it. So you create another one. And now there's 12 control families out there. That's sort of how I feel about a lot of these, too. Because, like, why do we need ISO and CIS and CSA and PCI and HIPAA? Like, it'd be nice if we could consolidate some of these, but then we'll just get another control family. So it's not too bad. But it's a dream that I have that someday some governing board of smart people is going to be like, this is just too complicated.
Whatever happened to the Cloud Security Alliance?
They're still out there.
Cloud Control Matrix. I haven't heard about that for a long time. I know it still exists, but it's not a hot topic anymore.
Well, I do have noticed the CIS is pretty rapidly dropping like new frameworks for things. Like they already have an AI framework out. They already have Snowflake frameworks. Like it seems like CIS is giving a lot of guidance now. And I don't know if CSA just sort of has fallen behind. I'm not part of that group, so I can't say what's going on inside of that one. But you know, it definitely exists out there. I do see it in a lot of the products you can buy to do cloud security. They talk about mapping to the CSA standard. But yeah, I don't know what's really happened to it.
Yeah.
Well, someone knows, they can let us know.
This is a neat feature, though. A number of times I've had to go in and, you know, prove that, take screenshots, you know, prove that the backups are being backed up, prove that things are being done a certain way, prove that you have scaling. This is great. Mm-hmm.
So I think I figured out the average length of time for PFR requests to get rolled out. Because in the last like 2 months now, a bunch of the things that I know Ryan or Jonathan or myself or other colleague, Andrew, basically had, submitted to AWS's PFRs have all gotten released, which is sort of interesting in like exactly right about 5 or 6 years. And so this week we got another one. This week, it's now easier for AWS organization customers to centrally manage the root email address of member accounts across the organization using the CLI, SDK, and organizational console. They previously made it possible to update primary and alternative contact information and enable AWS regions for their accounts using the organization CLI. However, you'd still need to log in as the root account, find your MFA process if you're properly following the CSA, and then change those things, which was really a big problem. But not anymore, as the SDK, CLI, and Organization Console have all been updated to allow this to be done at the organizational level, and the API require customers to verify the new root email address using a one-time password to ensure that you're using an accurate email address for the member accounts. The root email will not change until the new email is verified. I would like to also maybe add an old address verification just in case a hacker got into my organization and is trying to change all the root accounts. You know, appreciate this regardless, that this is a good step in the right direction.
Why do we even need an email address associated with it? If you have an organization set up, why even have an email address?
Don't ask questions that date back to 15 years ago when Amazon started and they thought it was important and they didn't have any idea of an organization or an account structure or that people would want multiples of them. Like, there was mistakes that were made. Like, yeah.
At least they separated the AWS logins from the Amazon.com logins. So, oh, you know, so you couldn't have somebody ordering, you know, pairs of shoes on your AWS bill.
That reminded me of something that happened today. So I went to the office today.
Sorry.
And I know. And I happened to have a box on my desk, and I was like, what is this box? And I pick it up and it's very light. I'm like, well, whatever it is, it's, you know, maybe I haven't served, who knows what this is. So I open up this box, and inside is a shoebox from Rubrik Inc., which is a security vendor. And inside of the shoebox, I did not find shoes. I found a little postcard that said, please scan this QR code and set up a demo with us and we'll buy you a pair of shoes. And I'm like, you guys shipped this to me from wherever you guys came from. This is a terrible marketing plan. So not only did you, you know, hurt the environment shipping a box that was basically, you said it was 2 pounds, but there's no way that box is 2 pounds. That's what the label said. You paid a crap ton of money to ship it to me, and now I'm not going to do business with you because I think you're terrible at marketing. So bravo.
I thought the empty box was a joke. Like, this is your cloud security that's empty, right? Like, that was.
I mean, like, there's a lot of metaphors you can use about cloud security of empty boxes. But if you'd like to check this out, it's out on my Twitter feed. I tweeted about it earlier today because I was so annoyed. And I just said, this is a marketing fail. But yeah, if you'd like to see the box and the empty box, yeah, it's right there up there on my Twitter feed. So anyways.
That'd be better off sending you the shoes, right? And then you only get the laces. Once you've had the demo, right? Like, at least give me something to come look forward to.
Someone tweeted that they should have stolen my shoes to force me to do the demo. That would have probably been more effective. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyways, empty boxes shipped to me at whatever expense. It's good. You know, I don't know who their VC is, but maybe they should look at that marketing.
You might want to look into that.
It's probably surplus shoe boxes from a...
I mean, it's Rubik branded. It was their colors, their logos, plaster. Like, they paid a lot of money for that. I used to work at a box company. I know how much they paid for that box. All right? The box is not cheap. And then you shipped it. Well, actually, and it was a shoebox inside of a box. So it's two boxes that you're burning in this that have to be recycled now.
Anyways, man, if only this had been a story in the thing here, we could have written a show title about it. It sounds like Dr. Seuss. Shoebox, two box.
So, yeah.
The empty box instead of the other box is a pretty good metaphor for cloud security too.
Yeah, that's a good one too. Yeah, there's lots of metaphors. All right, well, getting back to quality of life improvements from Amazon requested many years ago. Amazon is now announcing the ability to filter EC2 instance type finder directly from the console, enabling you to select the ideal Amazon EC2 instance type for your workload, as long as your ideal one is one that you know what the specs are. Using machine learning, which is an interesting choice, to help customers make quick and cost-effective selections, such as types before provisioning workloads. This is done by using the manager console, specifying your workload requirements, and getting recommendations directly from the ML. The finder is integrated into Queue, so you can use natural language to specify your requirements, like, hey, I need 12 pre-CPUs and 25 gigs of memory, and I'll give you instance family suggestions. And I mean, this doesn't seem complicated at all for something that would be a relatively easy filter grid view thing. Which is what I would have asked for 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, apparently we're going to take simple problems and now throw AI at them because, you know, logic's hard.
Me and Jonathan were scheming, you know, in our cynical ways before the show, like trying to figure out, like, you know, what's the angle here, you know? And I'm like, of course, Amazon's going to steer you to the largest, most expensive, you know, instance. And Jonathan's like, no, it's much more insidious. Yeah, no, I like most of these enablement tools, I'm very skeptical. I think they're a good thing to have, I guess. But without playing around with this and my avoidance of Amazon Q. I'm never going to play around with this.
And it's hard to avoid Amazon Q. It's kind of front and center all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to see it replace Google searches because, I mean, everyone Google searches, you know, AWS, EC2 instance, blah, 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 or how do I do this on AWS? And it's always Google that gets the hit and always Google that gets the answer for you, and then Amazon are paying if you click on one of their sponsored links or something. I'd like to see Q just replace Google search. If I got an Amazon question, I want to go to Q and ask it the question. I want it to be as good as the Google search has ever been.
I don't know if they're going to be context specific. Like, as a user, like, I don't want to go to the specific AI bot. I want to ask a question and to the ether, essentially, and have it generate that. So I think that's going to be the search engine replacement is going to be. It's going to just go to open AI and the same transaction is going to occur.
So even worse, I hadn't looked at this earlier. So why you guys are babbling on about this? I decided to go try it. So this is kind of hilarious to me. So it basically it's in the launch an instance wizard, which is always my favorite place to start out and build.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, like when you get down to the instance type sections of this form, it's a drop down there, you know, of all the instance types, and it tells you the on-demand pricing, Windows, Red Hat, Linux, etc. And there's a little button that says get advice. And so if you hit the little get advice button, it opens another window, which has four questions. What's your workload type? Which has a long list of things like web app, server, cache, data warehousing, deep learning, ETL, Hadoop, Kubernetes, etc. So I chose NoSQL because why not? Use case, you had to then tell it web hosting, application hosting, backup disaster recovery, etc., etc. So I'm going to pick one that's, I'm going to go, because they don't say database, of course, because why would you do such a thing like that? I'm going to go application hosting with my NoSQL database workload. And then I can choose a priority of price, performance, high performance, low cost, or no preference. I'm going to go no preference because why would I put a preference in? And then I can tell it CPU, Amazon, Intel, AMD, or an Apple Mac.
That's cost effective to run MongoDB. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm going to go no preference there again. And then advanced parameters. I can then add a generation. I can add number of vCPUs. I got a number amount of memory, instance storage required, or network performance. That's an optional thing you don't have to do. So I'm not going to do that this time just because I don't feel like clicking more buttons. And I just hit get instance type advice. And then I can tell that it's literally sending this out to Q and returning back the response from Q. And
can I guess what it's going to say?
Yes, go ahead. What would you like to guess?
I'd like to guess an R5X large.
You would be wrong.
T3.
You'd be wrong as well. The recommended, so the additional information is the recommended IM4GN, IS4Gen, and R7G instance families are based on AWS Graviton processors suitable for hosting NoSQL workloads for application hosting use cases with preference for price performance. The image IM4Gen and IS4Gen are storage optimized instances offering the best price performance for storage intensive workloads with up to 40 to 40% lower cost per terabyte of storage. The R7G instances powered by the latest Graviton 3 processors provide the best price performance for memory-intensive workloads like NoSQL databases, offering up to 25% better performance over the previous Graviton 2, which why do I care? And then Image 4Gen and IS 4Gen are designed for high network bandwidth, and then the R7G are local NVMe SSDs for available workloads requiring higher network bandwidth and local storage. But like none of that actually helped me make a decision.
All right, find me
Graviton.
Find me some questions, answers to those questions that do not result in Graviton being the answer.
Yeah, that would be fun.
I could go back, hit try again, which is nice. I don't have to go re-answer all the questions. And I can change this preference to Intel. Would you prefer Intel or AMD?
Well, what we're trying to do is see how much AWS is steering our choice, right? So Intel is too big of a hammer.
Because there's no preference for that, but change the workload type.
Okay, I'll do that. Workload type, what would you prefer? Would you like a Spark? Would you like streaming, video encoding, SAP, SAP HANA?
Let's do video encoding.
Video encoding. All right. Do you have a priority preference you'd like? Price performance, high performance, or low cost?
Middle of the road.
Right. We did no preference before, right?
Yeah, I did no preference before.
Yeah.
And then do you want to change the use case from application hosting to something else? I can do application development, testing, gaming, content delivery networks, or no preference on use case.
Content delivery.
Let's do it. For this one, it's recommending to me the C7G, C7GN, and the C7GD instance families powered by AWS Graviton 3 processors.
I think Ryan was right about steering people in a certain direction here.
Yeah. I don't know that Graviton is the best choice for video transcoding. That's maybe, I don't
price
know.
Price performance. That's all that counts. Apparently they got a surplus of Graviton 2s. So they're trying to
if I go high performance, I get C7Gs. If I go low cost, I get C5Gs. Okay. So they just downgrade the instance of the Graviton to the Graviton 2s. Thanks. So anyways, so this feature, I appreciate that it's there. I'm gonna question some of it, but
Graviton appreciates that it's there too.
Yes, it does. The Graviton team makes more margin. Is very happy about this new feature. All right, next up, Amazon ECS on AWS Fargate now allows you to encrypt ephemeral storage with your own KMS key. That's
fantastic. Except for I don't want to manage my own keys unless my customers absolutely make me.
Well, you're going back to that pesky security team that wants you to use your own keys, so Amazon can't access your data, because that makes sense. Mm-hmm. They would like you to think otherwise.
Yeah.
And that's it for Amazon before we head into reinforced territory. And could you guys perhaps guess what the very first announcement on main stage at Reinforce was about?
Was it AI?
It was AI, of course. First up was AWS Audit Manager now includes an AI best practice framework on AWS Audit Manager. This framework simplifies evidence collection and enables you to continually audit and monitor the compliance posture of your generative AI workloads through 100 standard controls, which are pre-configured to implement best practices requirements. Some examples of those requirements are gaining visibility into potential PII data that may have not been anonymized before you being used in training models. How would you know that? Validating that MFA is enforced to gain access to data sets, and periodically testing backup versions of customized models to ensure that they are reliable before a system outage occurs, among other things.
I mean, I think this is the only way you're going to be able to secure something like AI workloads. So it's cool. But yeah, what a mess.
Yeah, I would like to know how you determine this is potential PII data, because you had a PII data somewhere else that you used to train your model of PII data. Like, who's buying all that dark web information?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, John Baker, I've seen him before.
Yeah.
You get his password exposed in the 2002 Home Depot hack. Yeah.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
So did I. And so did Ryan, I'm sure.
Yep.
That's why I picked it.
Yep. That's interesting.
I think it was the first time I ever got credit monitoring. And I was like, this is a dumb remedy for me. But okay.
And now I just sign up for the new one, whatever one du jour.
Yeah, whatever one I get this week, I just sign up for that one. And I hope they don't all expire before I get the next one.
All right. If the first one was AI, is the second one BI?
Nope. It's also AI.
Oh, curses.
Nice.
You can now use
good dad joke, though. You had to give your credit for the dad joke.
It was good.
Wait till the follow-up.
You can now use generative AI-powered natural language query generation in AWS CloudTrail Lake, which is a managed data lake for capturing, storing, accessing, and analyzing AWS CloudTrail activity logs to meet compliance, security, and operational needs. You can query things like, tell me how many database instances are deleted without a snapshot, or how many errors were logged during the past month for each service, and what was the cause of each of those errors? Like, it would know. Come on.
I mean, that said, having spent countless hours generating Athena queries and indexing, you know, this, I love this feature, because this is really where I think generative AI is helpful, is that sort of last translation layer.
I mean, I think of all of the terrible regex formats you had to, your HCL type things, you know, you had to learn over the years to learn these crazy search parameters. This is my favorite feature of AI in all cases. And I was just doing Athena the other day on working at some ALB logs, because of course that's all in S3. And I was struggling with syntax on something, and I was like, man, I wish you guys had put AI here, because this would be an area that I would actually use it. I tried Q, but it failed me. So
it
didn't know enough about my data set to help me. So I was like, I'm trying to figure this out. And here's an example from the docs. Thanks.
You think they cache those results before they pass it? You know, obviously between the AI RAG call and the CloudTrail, I think you actually have some kind of caching, because it could get very expensive very quickly if you're scanning, you know, gigabytes or more of logs for every time somebody asks a dumb question. A question, sorry.
I mean, you would hope so.
I mean, I think it's, you know,
why is my bill so high?
As expensive as the billions of Athena SQL queries I also generated while trying to struggle through syntax. I'm not sure Yeah.
I mean,
simply, I fought with that Athena problem for a good hour, writing all kinds of weird queries that ran for, I don't know how many seconds, and it cost me $7. So
yeah,
didn't really bother me so much. Yeah, like, I'm just looking at the pricing examples. There's no special pricing for the AI usage of this. I mean, but it uses Athena under the hood, so you're paying for Athena.
I think that's going to be the real kicker, though. Is it $7 plus this AI surcharge, right? Or is it just $7, right? Because it's
right, there's just CloudTrail Insights too. I just like, I just like to use that. I'm like, just give me the knowledge that I need to have. I don't want to think about this so much.
Well, Insights is different, right? Insights is I tell you what's important.
Yeah, which is fine. I'm okay with that. Like, I don't know a lot about security in some of those areas. So, you know, you probably know more than I do. And then when you tell me something that I don't understand, I can ask you dumb questions. That's the ideal scenario. Well, I'm pretty sure I had this as a prediction for reInvent or some other thing many moons ago when they were building a bunch of pre and post processors for S3 object uploads. Mm-hmm. And then I was just disappointed and I just swore it off. They're never going to do it. But now they're here again, doing the thing I needed many moons ago. They're announcing the general availability of Amazon GuardDuty malware protection for S3. This is an expansion of Amazon GuardDuty malware protection to detect malicious files uploaded to select S3 buckets. Previously, they only do malware protection on scanned EBS volumes attached to EC2 instances or your container workloads. The GuardDuty malware scanning uses multiple AWS-developed and industry-leading third-party malware scanning engines to provide malware detection without degrading the scale, latency, and resiliency profile of Amazon S3. Unlike many existing tools, this managed solution from GuardDuty does not require you to manage your own isolated data pipelines or compute infrastructure in each AWS account and region where you want malware analysis. You can configure post-scan actions on GuardDuty, such as object tagging, to inform downstream processing or consume the scan status information provided through Amazon EventBridge to implement isolation of malicious uploaded objects. S3 objects will get a predefined tag as well, such as no threats found, unsupported, access denied, and failed. And you can find the results of the scans in the GuardDuty console as well, telling you what it's failed on. And the pricing is based on gigabit volume of the object scanned and the number of objects evaluated per month. It comes with a limited AWS free tier, which includes 1,000 requests and 1 gig each month, pursuant to conditions for the first 12 months of account creation or until June 11, 2025, for existing AWS accounts. It's 60 cents per gigabyte scanned and 21.5 cents per 1,000 objects evaluated.
That's not terrible.
Not bad.
The kind of kicker about this, though, is that the types of organizations that would want to pay for something like that are the types of organizations that would want client-side encryption or something else, which would completely prevent GuardDuty from scanning any of the objects that got uploaded.
That's so, just one more reason not to use client-side encryption for this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a case of the security controls kind of modernizing slightly and finally getting around to trust that these cloud providers can't be trusted. Unless they're Google or Azure or Oracle.
I mean, I did send this to my account rep at Google, and I said, hey, can you just copy this?
Yeah.
Because this use case is a big pain in the butt for anybody who has them. So I appreciate all the cloud vendors copying this one. Just do this.
That's neat. It beats trying to build in some free antivirus into a Lambda function, which I remember doing a few years ago.
You don't want to use Avast for that? I don't understand. Yeah. It's so weird. Or Clam AV, is that the one?
Clam AV was the one I did, yeah. That was only because I was running it in a container, but it was the exact same workload. Mm-hmm. Event, trigger, scan. Yeah.
Cool.
Well, Amazon is extending IAM Access Analyzer to make it more powerful by extending custom policy checks and adding easy access to guidance that will help you fine-tune your IAM policies. Both of the new features are built on custom policy checks and the unused access analysis launched in 2023. New custom policy checks uses the power of automated reasoning. The new checks help you detect policies that grant access to specific critical AWS resources or any type of public access. Both of the checks are designed to be used ahead and deployed. Deployment possibly as part of your CI/CD pipeline and will help you proactively detect updates that do not conform to your organization's security practices and policies. Guided revocation, IAM Access Analyzer now gives you guidance that you can share with your developers so they can revoke permissions that grant access that is not actually needed. This includes unused roles, roles with unused permissions, unused access keys for IAM users, and unused passwords or IAM users. And I'm really just disappointed that they didn't announce AI for IAM. Because if any place I would want IAM with AI, AI would be with IAM. If I could get the letters right.
It is interesting how they stopped just short of that. And like, it uses automated reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah.
No, that's provable. That's the difference.
Yes, well, it's provable.
That's, by math. That's Colm's work for you right there. That's yep. That's provable.
That's cool. Most
AI yeah. is not.
I wonder what Colm's opinion of AI is. That'd be a fun drinking conversation yeah, with Colm.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely something I've always sort of wanted to build in, like the CI/CD example use case is exactly the type of thing you want because it's the feedback is in the right place. The implementation, I'm a little not sure if you'd get that implementation in the right place unless you're in the console, which is cheating.
Well, this is the, I mean, this is also the thing that you and I got really excited about when we went to Reinforce the first time. They showed us all the math proofs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the fact that you can actually create custom policies and do your own math now is like,
yeah, it's pretty only sweet. Took,
you know, however many Reinforces have happened since we went to the first one for that to get to this point. But I, you know, I appreciate this is here.
To be fair, I still don't understand the math.
I don't either, but I can now apparently get close to writing it. Mm-hmm. So, well, Amazon is adding passkey and multi-factor authentication for root and IAM users. Passkeys will enhance security and usability of your AWS usage. Basically, for root, they will be turning on automatically. So, or not automatically, but they'll be forcing you the next time you log into your root account to enable MFA. And one of those MFA choices can, of course, be passkeys. This is a big change as they've been had a lot of breaches, perhaps recently, like Snowflake's, where they did not enforce MFA usage, and that tends to be a problem. For those of you who are not aware what passkeys are, they are a general term used for the credentials created for FIDO 2 authentication. A passkey is a pair of crypto keys generated on your client device when you register for the service or website, and the key pair is bound to be the web service domain and unique for each one. And the whole idea of this is that you can get away from those pesky passwords, so if your phone gets stolen, you're completely owned.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the implementation because I haven't heard passkeys linked to that FIDO 2, and so now I've connected those dots, and now I'm trying to think through like management of these things because they're like it's all stored on your client device, no problem. I'm like,
yeah, but you have another key, which is your fingerprint and your face, which decrypts the passkey, which is the one that they use to authenticate yeah. the other thing with. So it's yeah.
I've only had experience with one passwords implementation of it and with Apple's. So Apple, when you turn enable passkey, it pops up a QR code. You pick up your phone. You have to scan it with the camera. And then it has a face ID authentication and then unlocks it through that. And that one I feel pretty good about. The one password one is just it pops up a button and says, do you want to use your passkey? And you hit enter. And it just does it. So that one I'm a little less excited about. It's interesting.
Mm. It's interesting. I mean, it's really old technology, which is really funny. I mean, it's like G2G things where website provides you with something which is encoded or encrypted with your public key, and you have to decrypt it and send it back again. Mm. And that's been around for decades. It's just funny that it's only just getting to be adopted by mainstream. Like the dark web websites have been using this kind of technology for logins forever.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like when Ryan told me that DNSSEC has been around forever, and I just seem an idiot. I didn't know that.
Well,
we simplified it enough for the average consumer to use it now. Also, hi.
Hi.
Hey, Matt.
Yeah, branding's everything. So now we can call it passkey, and you know what we're referring
excited to. About it, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not, I'm not fully sold on the whole passkey thing quite yet. So... again, it's you can't have it as your only MFA option. You have to have another MFA option as well, which is interesting. Apparently, Amazon doesn't trust quite yet either.
I kind of like. I mean, MFA is great, but I want multiple factors of that. So, if I do lose my phone, just a password won't be enough. Just a face ID won't be enough. Just a fingerprint won't be enough. I want to have like a physical. If my phone restarts, I want to like plug a USB, like a, like a YubiKey or something in.
I have a Titan key, which is Google's version of the YubiKey, and it has USB-C, and I can plug it into my phone, I can plug it into my computer, and it's pretty nice. But I haven't quite fully adopted that use case in the world because I'm like, I always had to have my keys with me then. And that is not a use case that I want.
Yeah, I have the YubiKey-C, the small micro one that just attached to your computer. It's very light.
You mean the one that you're supposed to leave in your computer all the time? Because that's not insecure at all.
100%. But at least in the same type of thing. When I need to attach to my phone and multi-factor in because USB-C is on the phone. So nice and easy.
All right. Next up is AWS is announcing Service Insertion, a new feature of AWS Cloud WAN that simplifies the integration of security and inspection services into cloud-based global networks. Using this feature, you can easily steer your global network traffic between Amazon VPCs, AWS regions, on-premise locations, and the internet via security appliances or inspection services using central Cloud WAN policy or the AWS Management Console, of course. You deploy the inspection services or security appliances such as firewalls, IDS, IPSs, and secure web gateways to inspect and protect your global cloud WAN traffic. Now, service insertion customers can easily steer that traffic, as mentioned. And this will simplify you having to create multiple and complex routing configurations or third-party automation tools. And you can define this in a central policy document and make it apply to all of your cloud WAN or break all of your cloud WAN at one time.
Oh, cool. So apart from Cisco and Palo Alto, who else cares about this?
I don't know. People using Amazon Cloud WAN service versus Cisco.
I kind of wonder. I wonder if it solves the bandwidth limitation per instance. I wonder if they somehow do some magic so that they can route enough traffic to enough instances.
Probably not.
Without having that 10 gig constraint
for WAN.
Yeah.
I assume they do something like an ingress through a. Oh, what's the third type that you never use? It's not the application. It's not the network load balancer.
Gateway load balancer? Oh, yeah, that. And the transit gateway?
Yeah, so they probably use something like a gateway load balancer and then from there out. Because the whole point of the gateway load balancer is really for ISVs to leverage to solve that problem that you're talking about.
I don't know. And then the last thing they decided to announce during Reinforce, AWS announces the general availability of Amazon CloudWatch application signals, an open telemetry compatible application performance monitoring feature in CloudWatch. That makes it easy to automate, instrument, and track application performance against their most important business or SLO for applications on AWS. With no manual effort, no custom code, and no custom dashboards, Application Signals provides service operators with a pre-built standardized dashboard showing the most important metrics for application performance, volume, availability, latency, faults, and errors for each of their applications on AWS.
Was this specifically a Reinforced announcement or just...
That's an odd one. Yeah. During the middle of the Reinforce thing, so it got lumped in. I don't know.
Okay. Oh, I was just curious because it's just sort of like.
I don't know. I don't know if it was in the keynote because I watched 20 minutes of the keynote and I fell asleep. So that was
nice. Yeah. I thought it was tomorrow, so I'm no better.
Yeah. I mean, the recording is available to you at any time you'd like, tomorrow included. Yeah. So, but yeah, Reinforce is continuing. So we'll see if anything else comes out the rest of the week. But I doubt it.
I mean, this is going to give you a certain amount of cardinality right out of the box, just like most APM tools do.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than nothing.
Yep. Better than logging every request. So, CloudWatch will still get their money.
Moving on to GCP. Google's Kubernetes Engine is announcing a game-changing feature for Google's Kubernetes Engine enterprise customers, built-in, fully managed GKE compliance with GKE posture management. Now achieving and maintaining compliance for your Kubernetes cluster is easier than ever before. With GKE compliance, you can easily assess your GKE clusters and workloads against industry standards, benchmarks, and control frameworks, including CIS benchmark for GKE and the pod security standard. It also gives you a very handy centralized dashboard to make your reporting easy, updated every 30 minutes.
If it wasn't for that dashboard, you would have completely lost me. But now, again, I can just point compliance people at a pre-built thing and be like, look, green good.
Yeah. I tried to send this to the team earlier to see if they could use it, and they could not because there's some new permission that you need to enable in the Cloud Center of Excellence. So if you could get on that, great.
now it comes full context. Now it's full context. I understand what's going on now.
Yeah. It does look cool though. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's not that fancy of a dashboard. It doesn't tickle my executive brain. Ooh, properly.
Well, that's a fail.
I mean, I think it makes a compliance person happy though, because it's got green and orange and, you know, but I like line graphs more. So just
I see.
Yeah, it's probably more targeted towards the auditor and everyone else. You'd be like, look, we're good. See, even Google.
See all green? Green is good. Mm-hmm. Go away. Green good. Go away.
That's what we want. Yeah. Signals.
Well, Google is boosting developer productivity with the new pipeline validation capabilities in Dataflow. Apparently, data engineers building batch and streaming jobs in Dataflow sometimes faced a few challenges, including things like user errors and their Apache Beam code sometimes go undetected until the job fails while it's already running, wasting engineering time and cloud resources. Then fixing that initial set of errors that are highlighted after a job failure is no guarantee of future success, with subsequent submissions of the same job may fail and highlight new errors that require additional fixes. This is just software engineering. Like, what? Mm-hmm. This is every day of my life writing code. Like, it didn't work. Let me go fix it. And then I try it again. Oh, that worked. But now this is broken. To solve this, Google is announcing pipeline validation capabilities in Dataflow. Now, when you submit the batch or streaming job, Dataflow pipeline validation performs dozens of checks to ensure that the job is error-free and can run successfully. Once the validations are completed, you're presented with a list of identified errors along with the recommended fixes in a single pane of glass, saving you time you would have previously spent on iteratively fixing errors in your Apache Beam code.
I think you could absolutely measure the maturity of a data engineer by their ability to write a new feature and then test against a subset of a data and how refined that is. Cause I know the first thing I do is like learn by doing. And then you point that like at a petabyte data set. You're like, oh no. It's like undo, stop. And it just, yeah, it's not how that works. And so this is cool. Like it's sort of building that in where it's like, I'm sure it's doing exactly what I'm saying, which is testing against a smaller data set that it's carved off somehow.
I'm just imagining every Jenkins pipeline or every CI/CD pipeline I've done where it's like, okay, I built a pipeline. Now, how many commits does it take for me to get the pipeline to run? And yeah. How many commits?
This is my job. Like, this is software engineering 101. Yeah. Like you write the code, you debug the code, then you put it in the GitHub repo, and then the Jenkins job fails, and then I fix that, and then the Jenkins job fails. This is, why would you make this easier for me? Like, come on now.
Take all the fun and swearing out of my job.
I know. I mean, this is where my most inventive swears and rants come from. Is this type of fighting,
and they get captured for history, and they get
They do.
Well, it depends. Depends if you forcibly push over your Git history.
Oh, no, I don't do that. I leave the Git shame intact for everyone to see. That way they can see the pain that I went through to get this code working. Mm-hmm.
There was an old website that was like Git commits from last night.
Oh, good. I don't know how big is this thing. Where
it's filtered GitHub and public repos for swear words in it. Yeah. And that is it. And
it still works. Latenightcommits.com.
Oh, glorious. I'm sure it serves the same purpose.
I love that the third one I got was Django shit. Yeah, I could see that. That one resonates with me.
Yeah.
Damn, this is hard. I feel your pain, Zach, is beautiful. I don't know who you are, but I do agree. It can be hard sometimes. All right. Well, Google is announcing the Google-built PAM that they announced at Google Cloud Next is now available for you to play with in preview. PAM helps you achieve the principles of least privilege by ensuring your principals or other high-privilege users have an easy way to obtain precisely the access they need only when required and for no longer than required. PAM helps mitigate the risk of allowing you to shift always-on standing privileges to on-demand privilege access with just-in-time, time-bound, and approval-based access elevators.
I'm super excited by this. I think that this is something that will change the way we structure permissions. It's a great compromise from like the old Windows style where you had your two accounts, where you had everyone shared the same password between their two accounts, but you had two, so it was separate. Cool.
Don't tell your compliance person that.
I know. But this model of being able to sort of make a request flow or a pipeline where you're like, well, you normally don't have write access to your production, whatever, but you can have an approval flow and have that reach out to a source of truth. So there's an approved change window, or it can be approved by someone, or it could just log it somewhere. And this is fantastic because then it prevents that, use of having too many permissions and then also getting your credentials like fished or something. Yeah, I love it.
And they get fish still, just they had to fish it and use it right then.
Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me a little bit of, this is how you know I've been in Microsoft too long, their P2 licensing, which has like a just-in-time permission, where like essentially a third party, like if you want to elevate your permissions, it sends an email and says, so-and-so has elevated their permission. Just does somebody approve it. So it kind of feels like the same type of thing, but this feels a little bit more native to the cloud. That's like a email approval still because your email.
How dare you call a Microsoft thing not native to the cloud? How dare you, sir?
I can read the RCAs I get from them.
Yeah. The individual like sort of entitlements are configurable, right? So if you want it to be the same email thing, you could absolutely do that. If you wanted to have it generate an event and wait for an approval, you can do that too. So it's kind of great that you can do that. And then the fact that you can set it to auto expires, I love that so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's my favorite.
I definitely wish I was at a company where I could do it day one now with all these toolings. Because when we first implemented this at a prior job, you know, we had to invent a lot of this. Mm-hmm. And then it's gotten easier over the years. But now it's like, okay, now it's really easy to do this.
Yeah.
And then you know, couple this with zero trust networking and some of those things. And you get some really nice security workflows that I think are great.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about, you know, so if you think about our previous implementation, it actually wasn't compatible with like the newer SSO config for That's Amazon true. Either. So it's like you were sort of forced to choose your favorite, you know, whether mm-hmm. you wanted to do a much better identity provider SSO flow or do just-in-time access. So this is sort of, because this is in a different part of the flow directly at the cloud provider, you could have both.
Exactly.
At one point, we should have maybe we do it as an after show of like, if we build from day one, brand new company starting off, what would we do and how would we do it? Might be a fun conversation.
Oh, I think I would just cry.
I just wouldn't, I'd just do serverless.
Yeah.
Nothing with serverless. I'd like to do something with Mongo. No, serverless.
Yeah.
Pass. That's all serverless or managed services. Screw you. I don't care. Yeah. It has startup problems. Don't care. Make it work.
Yeah.
Not managing servers. Not doing Kubernetes. We're not doing any of that. Just serverless.
That is what I told one company that I worked with at one point. They were starting net new. I got in like the first day and I built them a CI/CD pipeline that just went to Fargate.
Nice.
All I think they still have to today. Fargate and a OpenVPN or something like that.
Even that's too much. Yeah, serverless. But, but I appreciate Fargate as serverless as that is with still having servers. But
yes, but I don't have to manage them or audit them.
That's true. So this afternoon, a groundbreaking multi-cloud partnership was announced. And I only know this because my sales rep from Google texted it to me and go, oh my God, did you see the news? And I was like, no. And he sent me the link. And the first thing I saw was Oracle and Google in the first two, three words. And I was like, oh my God, if they sold Google Cloud to Oracle, I'm going to murder someone. But that was not what it was. Oracle and Google today announced a partnership that gives customers the choice to combine OCI and Google Cloud technologies to help accelerate their application migrations and modernizations. Leveraging the Google Cloud cross-cloud interconnect, customers will be able to onboard in 11 global regions, allowing customers to deploy general-purpose workloads with no cross-cloud data transfer charges. And later this year, a new offering, Oracle Database at Google Cloud, will be available with the highest level of Oracle Database and network performance, along with the feature and pricing parity with OCI. So clearly, my Google rep, and sorry, because I know you're probably listening, doesn't follow the Azure news, because this is what Oracle and Azure did about 6 months ago. Yep. So I appreciate that. Groundbreaking, it is not, but it is appreciated if you are a Google customer who uses Oracle databases and have been frustrated with the lack of offerings. You can now take advantage of that directly from the OCI cloud and get probably some discounts because Oracle is still trying to get you to use OCI. And eventually you'll have an Oracle database offering directly from Google Cloud, probably managed by Oracle, just like Azure has. Both companies will jointly go to market with Oracle Database at Google Cloud, benefiting enterprises globally and across multiple industries, including financial services, healthcare, retail, and manufacturing, and more. Larry Ellison has a quote here. Customers want the flexibility to use multiple clouds. And to meet this growing demand, Google Cloud and Oracle are seamlessly connecting Google Cloud services with the very latest Oracle Database technology. By putting Oracle Cloud infrastructure hardware in Google Cloud data centers, customers can benefit from the best possible data set, database, and network performance. Sundar Pichai says, Oracle and Google Cloud have many joint enterprise customers, and this new partnership will help these customers use Oracle Database and applications in concert with Google Cloud's innovative platform and AI capabilities. And so as a customer of Oracle and Google Cloud, you get lots of flexibility here, ability to bring your own licenses of Oracle to the process and get new discount programs such as Oracle Support Rewards and a unified customer experience for all your Oracle needs, as well as access to all of the Oracle application services and capabilities. So congratulations to your Oracle customers who've been mad that they chose Google instead of Amazon or Azure. You now have the same capabilities.
You think Amazon will ever adopt this? Like ever?
You know, I was talking to somebody, he's like, well, isn't this like, it's not something they're the third people to support Oracle? And I'm like, well, technically they're the second, because I don't count Amazon's deal as the same thing. Because Amazon was so early that Oracle still thought cloud was a fad and stupid. And so they gave them a sweetheart deal to allow them to host Oracle on RDS. And so that's their original contractual negotiations, all that. And so I suspect that because the relationship at that time was very good between the two companies, although Amazon always hated Oracle, it got very bad afterwards. And Andy Jassy's the CEO of the company, who said very negative things about Larry Ellison many times on stage at reInvent. I'm going to say no.
Yeah.
But, you know, I could be surprised. You know, business is business. Money is money. And if, you know, Oracle and Amazon wanted to get together and do something, but the whole idea of, you know, Amazon not charging a per gigabyte fee for data transfer anywhere in the world would be shocking to me. So I just doubt it.
Yeah, no, I was leaning the same way, because it is one of those things. There would have to be a huge influx of customers that were choosing to go on Amazon or moving from Amazon for this specific workload, which I'm sure there are plenty. And, you know, these types of enablements, when you need them, are fantastic. Because the alternative is terrible. So
managing Oracle myself is terrible. You are correct.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I have been blessed in my career to never have to do that at the software level, only the hardware level.
I mean, it's not a bad product. I like I said all the time, it's a great database. I just don't like paying the license fees.
Even managing Oracle on RDS is painful.
It is. It's not a great, I mean, honestly, Amazon would be in the best interest of their customers, if they say they're customer focused and obsessed, would offer a database service from Oracle that they manage and care for, it would be a better experience.
So my only question about this is, what is Oracle support rewards, and why does it sound like I'm checking out at a grocery store?
It's not that, but I hear you. It sounds like a loyalty
program. If you have two rack clusters, you're silver status, and you get a third one for free.
Yeah, I think it's just I think there's a certain amount of money you spend on Oracle licenses. They give you a support reward, basically, of support they offer for free. It's basically like, here's the free support we gave you. They just call it a reward now. It's my rough understanding of it. And I will tell you, I did not read the T's and C's on this, so I don't know how Oracle is screwing you on that deal, but that's how they've been calling it for the last couple of years.
Just check me out being like, ooh, you spend another $500,000, you get another reward that gives you something.
I mean, you can get CloudPod rewards, and we'll just give you stickers. That's how it works.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
Stickers. But you will appreciate that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Moving on to Azure. I had one announcement that it wasn't AI relevant that I didn't care about, but it's still kind of boring. So I apologize. But Azure is adding on to the successful open sourcing of the Retina Cloud Native Container Networking Observability Platform, which I had forgotten about, with a new offering called Advanced Container Networking Service. It's a suite of services built on top of existing network solutions for AKS to address complex challenges around observability, security, and compliance. The Advanced Network Observability is now available in public preview. Advanced Container Networking Service is a suite of services built to significantly enhance the operational capabilities of AKS clusters. Suite is comprehensive and is designed to address the multifaceted, intricate needs. Okay, I get it. Log out all the buzzword. What does it actually do? Well, I still don't know, because the service brings the power of Hubble's control plane for both Cilium and non-Cilium Linux data planes to unlock Hubble metrics, Hubble CLI, and Hubble UI on your AKS clusters, providing deep insights into your workload. And yeah, so it uses eBPF, guys. It's CNI for container network interfaces. It visualizes it for you. That's what it does. Mm-hmm. And they could have just said that, but they didn't.
I mean, this speaks to the root of why I don't like Kubernetes in general, which is like, I like workloads where you're delegating responsibility boundaries and isolating things. And this type of networking in suite is because you're hosting multiple workloads and multiple different business entities and all kinds of things on your Kubernetes clusters. And so you need this visibility. You've got, you know, your different service mesh things running and trying to debug all these things, where it's, well, he could simplify.
But, yeah. But I did learn about Hubble from this, and Hubble has cool graphics.
Yes.
It has a really cool service map. and it has some really cool charts that are very, very up and down, very charty.
You are becoming a caricature of yourself.
I know. That's great. Isn't it? But I was intrigued by Hubble, but not enough that I would make anybody implement it. But, you know, because the other side is like, you can use Hubble metrics with Grafana. I'm like, why would I just use Grafana? Like, why all this complexity? Just use Grafana for all of this problem.
Well, that's meeting you where you are, right? If you already have Grafana, you want to do the thing. Yeah. But it is. It's so complex, and it is cool. I have definitely seen some cool stuff. And when you need to have the visibility because you've already made your bed, then these are nice tools to have.
Well, hopefully, our one Azure person on the podcast will use this and tell us it's cool.
I've still avoided Kubernetes for marriage here,
and you're better for it. You're already bald enough without the Kubernetes work. If you add a Kubernetes to it, it turns gray. That's what I learned.
So, yeah.
That's what happened to Ryan. His goatee started turning gray when he started looking at Kubernetes.
You were not wrong. It definitely did.
Indeed. Well, Oracle, I do have a couple other announcements other than their groundbreaking partnership with Google. So FinOps X is next week, Thursday and Friday. This episode will drop just right before that. I will be there if you happen to listen to this on your flight to FinOps X. I will be there. I'll have stickers, tweet me, or just find me. I'll be around the show floor. I'll be all over the place. I will have stickers everywhere, but at the Midway, I probably will not take stickers to the Midway party. But if you see me on the show floor, I will have a few. And so you can ask for a Flatpot sticker or a Lambda Spackle sticker or whatever I decide to bring. I might even have some pins. We'll see. Basically, Oracle is announcing ahead of that they are fully in support of Focus, with the 1.0 spec being now added to their OCI cost reports. And they are excited that you can now run all of your supplemental cost reports to the Focus schema, allowing you to get standardized transactional data that now you can use to determine your spend across multiple clouds in the same way.
Yay! Nah, I mean, this is so hard to do even with the unification, so...
Yeah, it's a step in the right direction.
Sure.
Yeah, now they all have it. So in theory, if you are running multi-cloud or using the brand new groundbreaking partnership that nobody else has done between Google and Oracle, you can at least see your bills kind of roughly the same way.
So Oracle's heard our complaints about their semi-truck data centers, and that's how they open regions so fast. And they decided to write a full blog post about how they build the touchless cloud region. They walk you through everything from this foundational section, which they call the first mile activities. Again, not helping with the truck assumptions. but overall, this is a cool article. It's a pretty geeky description of how they build out their cloud regions. They talk about inspecting the site, building the data center facility, the cooling, the generators. How do they go about building the cloud region software remotely? They don't even go to do it. How it gets orchestrated, etc. And so if you are a tech nerd who loves infrastructure, this is the article for you. To check out and read if you're curious how one of the cloud providers does their cloud provisioning of new regions.
Oh, man.
Which makes me kind of sad because I kind of just want to go to all the cool cloud regions to build them out. Like, I'm like, I don't want it to be touchless. I want to go. But maybe that's why they can do it faster than others.
Yeah. I mean, how touchless is it? Because it is sort of that thing. Like, all right.
I mean, rack and stack or server rack. That's not so touchless.
Yeah, not so much. Yeah.
but I assume that they're saying, like, we can have, people we pay $5 an hour in third world countries rack and stack this stuff.
Yeah.
As long as all the specifications are met. And then, once we have network access to it, we can just hit this button. Magic happens, which is cool.
Yeah. No, I mean, I lived this life for a long time, building out data centers in new regions and doing variations of this forever. So I'm super stoked by these things. It was a lot of fun. I miss it a lot. I don't really want to travel that much, and I'm older now, so I don't think I could really spend
as much time doing it.
The same amount of like 16-hour days on a data center floor in the cold and the noise. But
yeah, I definitely remember many data centers, breaking down cardboard, breaking down styrofoam, huffing it out to the thing, and then coming back and racking, stacking, getting cut by those little rack nuts. All the fun things.
I still hate those things.
Oh, bad memories and bleeding fingers.
I didn't get at least like 3 fingernails, like just totally scratched the crap out of my rack nut every day as I build out. I knew I'd failed. So
there has to be a better alternative.
There is. There's a company now. I'll send it to you offline. But there's a company now that makes the better rack nut that you don't have to do that terribleness anymore. But it didn't exist when I did rack and stack.
So slightly fun fact, the first introduction that Ryan had to torrent was actually a version of this, because Facebook, they would spin up a rack and they would plug it in, and then all of the applications and stack that were targeted for that rack would actually, via the torrent protocol, be fetched from multiple sources and configure that rack. Super cool. And then I was like, oh, and then people use this for like what? Pirating stuff? Cool.
I was able to find it faster. They're called rack studs. I didn't think my Google Kung Fu could be that fast, but Ryan talked for a minute on something.
You're welcome.
I don't know what you said, but
all the time. Can always be counted on that.
Yes. But yeah, so rack studs are the new alternative to rack nuts. So, which very male, very, very male oriented.
New bat, you know, I was going to let that one go.
But. Rack nuts and then studs. Yeah. Not very gender inclusive. Sorry about that. I didn't name it. All right. Well, I do have a cloud journey for you guys, only because Google has written up a couple blog posts I thought we should maybe chat about. So they started out a couple weeks ago with 5 myths about platform engineering, what it is and what it isn't. And Ryan happened to be gone that day. So I said, well, we'll save this for the next time. And between that time and now this time with Ryan, they had 5 more myths about platform engineering, how it's built, what it does and what it doesn't. And so I thought we'd talk about these. So the first myth they had, which I thought was sort of interesting, because if this is all you think platform engineering is, then I'm sorry for you. Myth number 1, a developer portal and an internal developer platform are the same thing.
Mm.
And they say on this one, basically, that a developer portal is an interface that helps software developers find and use the various services and tools that the IDP provides. A developer portal typically provides execution of self-service templates, a service catalog, visual representation of the application and service status, and documentation on the platform, application, APIs, or even the code itself. While an internal developer platform, on the other hand, enables developer self-service through the use of golden paths. The platform abstracts away technical complexities with approaches such as codified practices, setting company-wide configurations, and applying security controls. Each new service deployed from an IDP, for example, Google Kubernetes, is made immediately available on demand without waiting for any tickets, manual approvals, or meetings. So that's the first myth. What do you guys think?
I mean, I made a career out of building the second, so you know I like that. Yeah, I do like the distinctions a little bit. I've never heard like a developer portal before defined, and so like I sort of get the distinction they're drawing there. It's what I just sort of loosely lumped together as service catalog.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like that moment that you and I were at that Cloud Center of Excellence talk at AWS, and they were talking about all the things mm-hmm. that we've been doing for years that it didn't have names for, and we're like, oh my god, like, it's a framework I can use. Platform versus it makes sense. You know, internal developer platform versus developer portal. Yeah, it's a good distinction.
Yeah.
Myth number 2: we don't need an internal developer platform, and they say it depends. You really might need one. In fact, you probably already have one. Whatever your current method to get your code to production is your platform, and that might be a mess of different process systems and people, and most likely Jenkins. For example, if you have a set of tickets to file to different siloed teams, we say that you have a paperwork as a platform. Or if you speak to a specific individual to launch something, you have a people as a platform, which they lovingly mention Brent from the Phoenix Project.
Whoa. Nice.
Platform engineering starts with modeling the processes or an improved version of it that you have today and building software to do it for you instead of requiring every team to become experts in DevOps practices.
So I'm totally stealing paperwork platform. So
that is awesome.
Whoever wrote that at Google, 100%. Just send me a bill. I'm stealing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
I like the journey though of like, you know, they talk about, which is something I've never thought about, but essentially what I do, which is like, you know, it's people/paperwork as a platform and moves on to, you know, then, you know, my life goal is to automate myself out of a job because I don't like to do the same thing many times over and over again. You know, it becomes insanity to me. So like, I kind of like that journey and I like kind of where they go with it, which is you do have a platform. You just don't realize it yet, which I do like.
Yeah. You're doing this thing, but you're just, you haven't automated it. You haven't made it self-service. You haven't made it easy. You've made it, you know, not scalable, which, you know, is the big problem with those type of things. So myth number 3, platform engineering is just advanced DevOps.
No,
it's the thing that the poor DevOps team created in self-defense for people who think this.
In their article here, they go on to say that DevOps, we can all agree that DevOps is an organizational and cultural movement that aims to increase software delivery velocity, improve service reliability, and build shared ownership, where DevOps practices include version control, continuous integration, trunk-based development, continuous testing, yada, yada, yada. But the DevOps model can face scalability challenges due to an overwhelming management of infrastructure, and this may lead to cognitive overload, developer burnout, inconsistencies between teams, or cultural resistance. Platform engineering is happening today as a natural evolution to DevOps at scale. DevOps practices used in platform engineering include taking a developer-centric approach, automating infrastructure as code, security and compliance, observability, and continuous improvements. Platform engineering takes select DevOps practices and codifies them into software, so no, platform engineering isn't simply advanced DevOps. Think of it more as shifting DevOps down into the platform.
I couldn't agree more. That's exactly, you know, like I feel it is a natural progression based off of, you know, how complex, you know, things can be, how many different technologies you got to be an expert in, you know, and I think for a while, you know, DevOps being a philosophy that turned into a role, you know, I was always doomed for failure because of how complex it was. And this is exactly how you combat that. Just like any software is automating tasks, this is the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Myth number four, platform engineering is just automation. Automation lets teams reduce the need for human intervention when managing their systems. This can be done simply as in a shell script, or it can be much more complex, nuanced, and scalable. Generally, when people deride something as just automation, they're referring to large numbers of trivial shell scripts that often break. And it's true, automation can in fact introduce new, more difficult to solve problems. Due to this, avoiding unchecked automation is understandable, where systems begin to fail not due to the quality of automation, but due to socio-technical pressures like misinterpretation of signals, misunderstood designs, poor assumptions, or misaligned incentives. But whereas the bag of scripts approach to automation is piecemeal, platform engineering takes a much more holistic approach by considering the full system lifecycle from service creation, configuration, deployment, to monitoring, scaling, and eventual teardown. And so yes, platform engineering is indeed automation, but the platform is delivered as a product and designed for full service lifecycle, not just bolted on reactively.
Yeah. Yeah, your janky work, you know, combination of Jenkins workflows, that's just automation.
Yeah.
Like that's exactly how you start, you know.
But that's how you start the platform, and then you actually mm-hmm. you take a look at it and go, okay, none of these things are scaling. Let's now revamp and actually let's build the platform now that other teams are gonna leverage, because everyone's copy and pasted all these janky scripts 17 times, mm-hmm. made their small tweaks. So let's build a real platform out of it. So I think it starts out of automation and moves into a platform as the business needs it.
Number five in the first article, platform engineering is just the latest fad. In recent years, the complexity of designing and managing modern infrastructure and software stack has led to significant increase in the cognitive load placed on software development teams, so much so that it's become essential to abstract the deployment and management of the services. Today's platform engineering addresses some real-world problems, namely DevOps overload, or aka cognitive load, when teams become bottlenecks as they try to manage the growing complexity of modern software, Kubernetes, developer friction, a team's quantifiable slowdown from interacting with infrastructure tooling, policy, and processes. Platform engineering caters to the specific needs, processes, workflows, security, and infrastructure of an organization. Its goal is to reduce friction and cognitive overload, thereby improving developer experience. Related, platform as a service predates platform engineering, but it was not always the right fit for some teams. And so you might ask, how is platform engineering different from platform as a service? While platform service provides the technology to efficiently build applications to configure the necessary underlying infrastructure, it needs a surrounding ecosystem of people and processes to be adopted successfully. And platform engineering provides a method for a team to build an abstraction or extensions of products, including a PaaS, implementing the constraints or freedoms that are appropriate for their organization. In other words, platform engineering is the response to the technology-centric model of platform as a service, which doesn't work for organizations that might need further customization.
Yeah, the latest fad to me is, you know, signifies something that's going to go away as well. Something that's popular, but only in the short term. And I feel like because this is such a reaction out of things that aren't going away, like complexity and difficult environments, I can't see this being just a fad in that sense. But a definition of terms of stuff we're already doing, a way to label ideas and bucket them together so that you don't have to re-explain everything. Yeah, sure.
Myth number six. Platform engineering eliminates the need for infrastructure teams. Even if you have the best developer platform on the planet, it still runs atop a complex infrastructure, which always requires ongoing maintenance by specialists who understand it. After all, someone needs to architect, manage, scale, troubleshoot, and optimize that infrastructure. And try as you might, that infrastructure will continue to fail just as it did before you introduced platform engineering. A common mistake is to eliminate the infrastructure team and to expect a totally new team to make up for that loss. Infrastructure teams already have the expertise to handle these responsibilities and such are good candidates to become platform engineers. By using the team with institutional knowledge of the underlying infrastructure, you're more likely to adapt your current system into a viable engineer platform. However, what platform engineering does change is how infrastructure specialists prepare for and respond to failures, as the platform engineering role is more focused on platform development and less on manual, repetitive tasks. So while platform engineering changes the nature of infrastructure work, it doesn't eliminate it altogether. And you still need to build a self-service catalog of golden paths that developers can select to deploy their applications. And that catalog needs to be documented and refined, advocated for within the organization, and introduced to new engineers. And improvements to the platform also need to be rolled out to existing tenants.
It's weird because I kind of agree and disagree with that, a lot of those statements, like right next to each other. Because I've said for a long time that I believe that infrastructure teams are going to become infrastructure service teams. And, you know, another way to say that would be platform engineering, because they're taking their business value that they provide with their expertise of that infrastructure layer, providing it back in a serviceified format, typically through some sort of tooling. And so it's, I agree with them on that part. Does it eliminate the need? No, which they're not saying, but yeah, it's sort of strange. Like, I don't know. It's six of one, half dozen of another, I guess.
Yeah, well, I didn't read it, but finally, even the most mature platforms have components that fall outside the scope of automation, and infrastructure experts will still be responsible for them. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Like, I get it, but yeah. This one, I think, it really depends on how you define an infrastructure team. Mm-hmm. The guy who runs VMware, probably... Yeah.
Sysadmins? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, not those people. But yeah, your hardcore network engineers who understand OSPF and BGP and routing and how those things get automated, they have a tremendous amount of value in a platform type setup, I think.
Yeah, and someone, you know, similarly, if their deep knowledge of like an OS and the transactions at that level, like there's still going to be that specialty and that need. And I think that those people will be on platform engineering teams instead of in the basement.
Mm-hmm. They'll still be in the basement, but you know,
we're always in the basement. That's where the cloud people go.
That's true.
Number seven, introducing platform engineering will dramatically impact staffing costs. And they say this part of the building platform engineering is taking the people with the most DevOps skills, aka very expensive, within an organization evolving into the new structure. This allows them and the organization to better apply DevOps principles with fewer people using self-service automation and golden paths. A common concern is that the platform engineering team will require a lot of additional personnel. A platform engineering team indeed needs to be staffed, but that staff can come from existing operations and software engineering teams. Over time, the resulting platform should more than pay for itself by leveraging gains from shared services. In other words, the platform engineering team is an investment that you can fund from existing in-house teams. And one model is considered Google's SRE history of sublinear scaling. The teams responsible for ensuring availability set objectives to grow their headcount to a lower growth rate than the system they run. When introducing platform engineering, an anti-pattern would be to expect a reduction of operations staff or developers out of the gate. And retaining existing teams work well because they're already familiar with the business needs and have lots of experience with underlying infrastructure, whether it's exposed directly or via a platform. In fact, they observe that teams that adopt platform engineering can end up finding that more work can be done by the same individuals because there's a platform that they can leverage. And when implemented correctly, platform engineering increases efficiency and reduces operational overhead, including automating deployment pipelines, infrastructure configuration, self-service model reduces bottlenecks, and workflows become streamlined, allowing teams to do more with the same or potentially even fewer resources.
What's funny is that impact in what way? And then I was thinking about this, and I think one thing that is discounted or I haven't seen mentioned anywhere else is that when you're forming a platform engineering team and you're charting out your roadmap and all the things, you're using the same terms that if you're working in software development or any kind of SaaS company, you're using the same staffing and money and budgetary planning guides as your product application teams. So you're now all of a sudden, in my opinion, or at least in my experience, taking a very understaffed sort of operational side of the business and then converting that to using the same metrics and the same milestones in terms of delivery and trying to then try to, you know, solve that problem with the mythical man month, etc. And then it does lead to a bit of an expansion, but it's also just because it's been so horribly underfunded for so long. So it's sort of interesting.
Yeah, I also like the, you know, the essentially the Google model, which I've never actually heard the word for, but subliminal scaling, where in theory, as you have built out this platform for other people to do, you need less people. But like, I've kind of seen the opposite, where once you've kind of proven yourself within an organization, you end up gaining more responsibility. So while your platform team starts running A, B, and C right now, oh, there's this other business need we need to solve, and you've optimized A and B, so now you can move on to C and D, and you end up just acquiring more things as you've automated the maintenance and everything else that needs to be done for a lot of the first things. So within the team, you might end up with sublinear scaling, but not in the way that it actually is, but you're really just gaining more responsibilities.
Can you say sublinear scaling 5 times fast?
I don't think I can say it once, as we just proved it fast.
Number 8, adopting platform engineering today will quickly solve all my biggest problems. Of course it will, right? Mm-hmm. And any complex,
it'll also cause all your biggest problems. Yeah, exactly.
In any complex environment, hoping for a quick fix is almost always wishful thinking. Changes take time, and the timeline for that change needs to account for identifying your organization's constraints and how quickly it can curate relevant solutions. Nor is there a one-size-fits-all approach to platform engineering. It needs to be tailored to meet the specific needs of your organization. However, you can achieve fast results by building out a minimal viable platform, starting from a subset of your user base and creating a fast feedback loop. Starting with some pre-made MVPs can help bootstrap a team, but it's important to not make the mistake and think that you can buy your way out of this by adopting a fully built platform and presto, improving immediately. Investment, research, and introspection are the right path forward here. By starting with an MVP and adding capabilities based on early adopters' feedback, you can iteratively build a platform that starts delivering value quickly. Don't try to design the perfect platform with a 5-year plan. In short, platform engineering is a journey that requires a change in mindset across development and operations, a cultural shift to embrace the platform, golden path engineering, and tooling to address friction in the development process, all of which takes time to get right. And you will make mistakes, I will say right now.
Oh, yeah.
But learn from them and make less mistakes in the future.
And make new, different mistakes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with the, you know, like, I think this is one of those things you can't let perfect become the enemy of good. You really have to focus on building a foundation that is modular and can be expanded upon, because there's new technologies all the time. There's new patterns. And it's going to have to change. And because of where it is in the business, its agility is key for the business to function, because it can block all innovation if you let it. So,
Number 9, you should apply platform engineering practices to every application. Platform engineers actively analyze and identify tasks or processes which create a high cognitive load on development operations team, taking targeted actions to alleviate the burden. That does not describe all tasks and processes in a software delivery organization. And as such, consider applying platform engineering to applications where developers are overwhelmed by infrastructure complexities or the operation team faces constant friction. In these situations, a golden path approach can streamline development and management, and this typically involves selecting suitable cloud services, automating deployments, and establishing standardized configurations. First, focus on abstracting things that have the highest usage and toil, i.e. services that both take a high cognitive load and are frequently used. Make sure your abstractions provide value, sensible defaults, and along with guidance and explanations for why you made certain choices. Having break glass methods for stepping outside a platform if needed is highly encouraged. At least initially think in terms of building a platform for depth rather than breadth. Satisfy and automate common use cases as completely as you can before moving on to new ones. Similarly, don't start with the biggest, most important service to your organization. An anti-pattern is to adopt the biggest bang application first to maximize gains over time. This will likely fail, as teams haven't had the time to develop confidence in your nascent platform, or the platform doesn't yet have the requisite capabilities. Instead, start with smaller, less demanding services. And a team doesn't need to deploy every service when adopting the platform. You can aim to adopt some large percentage of them. There will always be strays.
Oh, yeah.
I like the sentence you said of the depth rather than breadth, because you need to choose something that you're going to provide to the business and really make it work for them. You know, and say, we're not going to solve every use case out there. Like, you know, all the cloud providers don't say they solve everything. You know, their databases only support these 4. They're not running CouchDB on RDS or any of the other. They chose the 3 that they're doing, or the 4 that they're doing, and they're really making it work all the way through. Yeah, there's always edge cases in there of something that might not work. Microsoft can't run their own SSRS on their managed SQL, you know, for some reason, but we're going to bypass that. And, you know, but they've proven that it works at the scale where they can. And that's what you need to do internally too, is prove that you can do it and then move on, you know, and then add on features, as you said. Like Ryan said, it's a very modular approach.
I did four guys on a podcast complain about your MVP that doesn't do everything we want it
to
do.
Oh, yeah.
100%. It's all here for.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think I like the idea of depth. And, you know, the one thing I kind of disagree on this is the biggest bang application first, because one of the things that you run into in cloud modernization, and I think it is a little different in platform, so I'll clarify this in a second, but in cloud modernization, you know, everyone says, oh, well, yeah, you can move those greenfield applications, but, you know, you can't move the monolith to the cloud. It's too complicated. It's too, and it's like, you have this kind of like natural, like anti-pattern of like, I'm not going to do it because it's the big moneymaker. It's the one that doesn't have any value. You know, it's too hard. And I agree that in the platform case here, I think you do want to focus on, you know, smaller applications first, but I do think you shouldn't wait to do the biggest bang application till last. I think that's a mistake for failure, because then you built this thing that supports 20% of your workload and you don't have anything solving the big problem in your organization and you're not getting the return on investment you need.
Yeah, I think a common mistake is that they do exactly that, right? They either start off with these small little use cases and just exclude their giant monolith and thinking that they'll get there eventually, right? Or thinking that, you know, the new microservice strategy is going to strangle that monolith and it won't become a problem in the future. I don't think starting with monolith is a good idea, but I think building your strategy to that monolith and having that path forward is the way to go. Because
kind of always have it in the horizon of where you're going is working that monolith. Towards it.
Yeah. And so, and then staying along that journey as flexible as possible, so that you can adapt to, you know, the changes that you're going to occur. Because it's going to take many years in most cases, right, to develop these things.
But I think the other thing too is as you build these new patterns and you have these new opportunities, that product or that monolith or that other big bang application isn't standing still either. Like how many applications are going through monolithic to microservices transitions, or they're adopting serverless, or they're doing these things. So if you're providing some of these new patterns in the platform, they might be able to start adopting it sooner than you actually realize. But again, it's all about making sure you design with the angle that you're eventually going to get there. So you're thinking about, okay, when we get to that, we need to have this capability, and it needs to be in your roadmap, needs to be in your architecture, et cetera.
And I'm the king of de-scoping projects, but like that one is one I won't sacrifice. Like there's a problem I can solve for that monolith and build into my platform. Even if it's just partial, I've fixed a tiny little portion of it. I absolutely include that, because that is the key to a lot of businesses. That is the moneymaker. And that is the thing. And if you can provide incremental value there, it's a great way to get exposed to that workload and to build confidence in your platform.
And our last one, all cloud services map to platform engineering. When people begin their platform engineering journey, they often ask us, does this cloud service map to platform engineering? Don't mistake adopting a cloud service for practicing platform engineering. This misunderstanding hinders effective implementation and suggests that there's an unclear understanding of what platform engineering actually is. While you can use any cloud service with platform engineering, what matters is how you integrate that cloud service into your developer experience through the platform. And so they have a list here of engineering practices and processes that you can decide for yourself whether a cloud service or product is fit for your purpose. So DevOps practice used for platform engineering, developer-centric approach, example processes, measuring developer experience, golden paths, self-service capabilities, automation and infrastructure as code, automate everything, infrastructure as code tooling, DevOps practice, security and compliance, security by design, guardrails, compliance as code. So as you can see, these aren't all cloud things, but they have cloud capabilities that you might be able to leverage to adopt those things, like in observability, which is one of the concepts, centralized monitoring, alerting, and troubleshooting tools. So your cloud provider probably has something, CloudWatch, Google Cloud Monitoring, Azure, whatever Azure uses, if they monitor anything. I don't think they do.
Not original.
Or like in continuous improvement, you know, that's, again, that's a more of a PM type thing. So that's a good piece of advice as well. So yeah, overall, I think this is a really good set of 10 things to get you thinking about platform engineering if your company isn't doing it. And so I thought I'd share it with you guys.
Yeah. No, this is fantastic. I'm happy to see things being written. You know, it's like you said, you know, it's like these things that I've been talking about, but not really thinking I had to communicate the idea like it was a new idea, to see them sort of picked up and see them out in the world where, you know, other people smarter than me have, you know, had the same idea. It's validating, and it's a great way to see that, you know, you're on the right path. I'm really happy to see it.
It also put a lot of words to thoughts I've had and I haven't really ever had time to kind of articulate it in such a way.
Yeah. I mean, it's still a pretty, I mean, the whole concept of platform engineering, like the big guys do it. Fang does it. Yahoo does it. Yeah. But, you know, but I think it's becoming more and more common now that the tooling is getting cheaper and easier to do. You have things like Backstage available or Atlassian Compass and things kind of be starting places. Again, they're not full solutions. You can't just buy that tool and have a platform. But I think that's becoming more and more of the how do you get DevOps to scale? Because mm-hmm. the cognitive load is a big burden for a lot of engineering teams. And if you think about it, you know, you're trying to have them shift left. They're trying to, like, do you really need them to understand networking? Do you really need them to understand storage? Do you want them to be able to adopt something that's opinionated and a golden path? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. All right, guys. Well, it was great. I will see you both next week here at the Cloud Pod.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
And that is The Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #poundthecloudpod.